Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, where today we're going to talk about the decision of the Kaiser and the German government to go to war in 1914 during the July crisis following the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And the story is quite a complicated one, because it involves not just the Kaiser and his ministers, but also the decision of the Social Democratic Party, the largest socialist party in Europe, to support the war effort, something that is replicated throughout nearly every European democracy on the eve of the war, and the more authoritarian states, obviously, like Germany and Austria-Hungary. Now, the book I'm looking at the moment is Ring of Steel by Alexander Watson, which is Germany and Austria's experience of war. A really interesting examination of the Central Powers at war, which really does throw off a kind of a lot of very sort of, shall we say, Anglo-centric views of the war and myths that we might have. So, well worth a read, published by Alan Lane, and one of their books of 2015. Okay, the story starts obviously with the assassination when on the 28th of June 1914, when Archduke Franz Ferdinand is on a visit to Sarajevo, the capital of the annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina, with his wife Sophie, Grand Duchess of Hohenberg. He's gunned down by Bosnian Serbs, who were in the pay of the Serbian military intelligence and had close connections with them. The Black Hand Gang, a nationalist terror gang, was essentially the creation of the Serbian military. And the Serbs, who had experienced this wave of kind of nationalist nationalist rejuvenation since 1878 and the creation of an independent Serbia, finally from the ashes of the European, the Balkan Ottoman Empire, and following the Russo-Turkish War of 1878, had been ever more assertive in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which they had a large the Serbian population, and the Serbs viewed it really as theirs. And the suzerainty of Austria over Bosnia-Herzegovina, first granted in 1878 and then created in 1878 as a fully annexed territory, was an affront to Serbian nationalism. The Serbs had been really an antagonist on the Austrian border for the best part of four decades, and the Austrians, fearing the spread of Serb nationalism, and national sort of fissile nationalism in general into their own multi-ethnic empire were happy to teach the Serbs a salutary lesson. And the chief of cabinet, sort of the chief minister, Alek Hoyos, saw of Austria-Hungary, saw the assassination as a magnificent opportunity, as he put it, to rewrite history. He said that a totally new epoch was being prepared, and Serbia was to eat humble pie. There had always been a sense in the Habsburg Empire that it was being it was suffering a death of a thousand cuts. The creation of a unified Germany had forced the Austrians out of any further control of the German Confederation. Creation of Italy had seen Austria's influence in the Alpine region of northern Italy and in the Italian peninsula itself curtailed. And now there would be a Slavic challenge, a Serbian challenge to Austria. Austria was always obviously mindful that the patron of the Serbs was Russia. The Serbs were seen as Slavic brethren, and the the Russian Tsars from Alexander II to Alexander III to Nicholas II viewed themselves as patrons of and protectors of the Orthodox faith within Russia's borders and beyond. On the 5th of July, Hoyos went to Berlin to sound out the German government and to see what support they would get. He took with him a letter from Austrian Emperor Franz Josef addressed to the Kaiser. It referred to Serbia's criminal agitation, which must not go unpunished. The second letter that he took was a memorandum which offered a pessimistic view of the Central Powers' strategic situation. That essentially that they were encircled. Given this was sent by Baron Franz Maschiko, and it was sent to the German government in order really to appeal to their anxieties. The idea of encirclement, of a ring of steel, hence the title of the book, around Germany and Austria, it was a very real fear. There was Russia in the east, France in the west, and Great Britain as well. And the effect was a sense that the German-speaking world, Austria and Germany, were existing under a state of siege. The Austrian Count Berchtold, the foreign minister, was a great enthusiast for war and believed that a war in the Balkans with German backing would keep Russia out and would secure Austro-German dominance in the Balkans and then in the rest of Eastern Europe for the foreseeable future. The Kaiser is receptive to these ideas. He had been a friend of Franz Ferdinand and was angry at his death. The Kaiser's view, which was written on a report filed by his ambassador in Vienna 2 days after the murders, was that the Serbs must be disposed of and that right soon. The point here being, though, of course, that given the Kaiser's previous over-personalised, emotional, unstable responses to world events and his sense of his own involvement in them and his own importance, this is, in essence, the sort of thing that he would have written, predictably. He gave a letter of his full support to the Austrians, and Bethmann Hollweg, his chancellor agreed to, and met Hoyos, offering him the infamous blank check. The blank check was a statement which was interpreted as, by Austrian diplomats, that whatever Austria decides, Germany will always be at Austria's side. So this was really giving carte blanche to Austria to escalate if it chose to do so, and not placing any conditions on that support, i.e. we will support you as long as you do, you act in ways which are in line with Germany's interests. Germany does this in the full knowledge that this is unlikely to just be a Balkan war. There would be the ability to provoke a serious European complication. Now, if you've read Christopher Clark's brilliant book, The Sleepwalkers, then you'll know that the middle section of the book focuses on the confusion that existed in Europe over the intentions of different European powers. You have foreign ministers contradicting prime ministers. You have monarchs contradicting sovereign governments. And there are all sorts of mixed messages from diplomats, ambassadors, even from the popular press in different European countries to one another, muddying the waters as to what each country intends, particularly during the July crisis, and what each country's red lines are, where they will negotiate and compromise and where they won't. However, here it looks as if the Kaiser has a reasonable understanding that the French and the Russians have a willingness to become involved in an attack on Serbia. One of the problems is that the Kaiser has a tendency to listen to the last opinion he heard. The 5th of July is a pivotal day. After he had acknowledged the possibility of a serious European complication, he then goes to lunch with Bethmann Hollweg, his Foreign Secretary Arthur Zimmermann, and some of the heads of the army. The Minister for War, Erich von Falkenhayn, essentially pours cold water on the idea that the Austrians are serious, and says that that they probably aren't, and even if they were, it's unlikely that they would be able or willing to act decisively. And if they did, that Russia probably wouldn't intervene. All of these, of course, as we know, are flawed assumptions.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Germans then... the German government and the military establishment, with these assumptions in mind, still think that it is basically okay and a low risk thing to do, to hand the power in terms of a blank assurance over to Vienna and to allow events to unfold as they do. Now, there is an argument to suggest that it would be inconceivable at this point of perceived encirclement for Germany to abandon Austria, that Austria ultimately has more power in the relationship, because if diplomatic ties between the two countries broke down, they would both be isolated. Austria would launch its initiative against the Serbs anyway, and Germany would be weakened in the eyes of the Entente powers, Britain, France and Russia. But the response in Berlin gives Berchtold, who is anxious for hostilities to begin, gives him a greater strength, a stronger hand to play when returning to Vienna and holding a full cabinet meeting, a common ministerial council, on July the 7th. There was no chance at that point that the Austrian army could be ready to attack the Serbs. The tradition of allowing soldiers harvest leave, so they could, the peasant soldiers could go home and work on the land, meant that it was difficult to get an army together that quickly. So instead, an ultimatum is sent to the Serbs, and as we know, it has a list of so many outlandish and outrageous demands that there's no way that the Serbs can possibly agree to it. One of the points that Alexander Watson makes is that the Austrians act out of not a sense of strength but weakness in 1914. They're desperate to conserve what they see as a dying empire. And it is the Germans that play a secondary role in the rush for war in July 1914, but also an extremely important one. The Habsburg rulers would never have thought, never have dared to go it alone unless they had that unconditional support given on the 5th of July. The Germans may have underestimated the threat of Russia, but they weren't completely blind to it either, and they knew that this would, if it did happen, result in a European catastrophe. So the question is there about the risk-taking. You know, why did they choose to take these risks? The meeting on the afternoon of the 5th of July, where the Germans responded to Austria's appeal for support, where Kaiser Wilhelm, War Minister Falkenhayn, and Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg were there, exemplified a kind of a curious mixture of indecision, fatalism, aggression, and the fearful calculation, that shaped the Reich's foreign policy. They'd in essence arrived at the Kaiser's final gamble. Kaiser, a saber rattler and somebody who thought that aggression or the threat of aggression on the world scene could bring about desired political outcomes, wanted to support the Austrians. He thought that backing a strong and assertive attack in the Balkans would be highly risky, but he allowed his advisers to tell him the reassuring things that he actually wanted to hear, to give him the words that would suggest that Russia really wouldn't get involved. Something interesting happens in Germany during the July crisis and during the, for at least the first year of the war, in that the country becomes extremely united behind the war. It says, this is quoting Ring of Steel, "Differences of class and confession, region and race seemed to many who had lived through these times suddenly to melt away in the national emergency. The Russian general mobilization decisively shifted popular opinion, turning war from an unthinkable horror into a defensive necessity. Now, that suggests that the view of Russia and the East and the possibility of the Russian army marching to Berlin, as once it had marched to Paris during the Napoleonic Wars, was a kind of a monstrous fear. There's obviously a great deal of... there's a kind of like a civilization and barbarism dichotomy that is drawn up in German thinking about Germany and Russia. Watson writes that the fear at the outbreak of hostilities was important in promoting readiness to suspend domestic quarrels and seek safety in solidarity. The Reich government also acted skillfully, however, in building consensus and cultivating unity. The distrust between Germany's conservative authorities and its largest political party, the Social Democrats, should not be underestimated. On the 30th of July, after German mobilisation was mistakenly reported in the Berliner Lokal Anzeiger newspaper, Friedrich Ebert, one of the party's two chairmen, and Otto Bauer, its treasurer, fled with the party finances to safety in Switzerland. As late as the 31st of July, as leaders reckoned that if war broke out, they would be arrested, obviously interned as dangerous subversives. It was thus little short of astounding and of immense importance for Germany's war effort that less than a week later, the party would vote unanimously for war credits, so for the finances to pay for the war. And its other chairman, Hugo Haas, announced to the Reichstag that in the hour of danger, we do not leave the fatherland in the lurch. So social divisions and social democratic politics are swept aside by the need for national unity. And why? Because many Germans did not view themselves as engaged in some political adventurism. They suddenly realised that the strategic picture of Europe was profoundly against them and that armies were moving against them. And the particularly frightening one is the Russians. And the fear of the Russians will unite the nation as never before. It seems that Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg had been a very canny political player, and from the start of the crisis he had been conciliatory towards the Social Democrats. On the 26th of July, Haas had been called to the Prussian Interior Ministry and told that he didn't have to worry about anti-war demonstrations from being suppressed, that that wasn't going to happen, and that the Chancellor had invited 3 days later, Haas, Bauer, and Ebert to visit him, but they were no longer in Berlin. And so instead, Albert Seedkamp, another member of the SPD, attended, and Bethmann Hollweg once again says that the Kaiser has only peaceful intentions, and in response, Seedkamp said that there would be little by way of strikes, sabotage or industrial unrest to stop the war. And the view that the Chancellor and the Prussian Ministry of State have was that the SPD had been effectively neutralised. And the feeling that the government had from the trade union movement was that they could appeal directly to its patriotism, and that Marxist ideas of workers of the world uniting and overthrowing the bourgeoisie, and that trying to turn conflict between nations into class struggle, and asking the workers of each country to lay down their arms against each one another and deal with the real enemy, so on and so forth, that wasn't going to happen. There's very little in Marx that would have predicted this. The view that Marx had was that inevitably the working class would see its exploitation and as a result overthrow its bourgeois oppressors. The history of the 20th century really presents little evidence of this having happened. And there are repeated instances of the allure of nation and the power of patriotism and national identity sweeping aside notions of class solidarity, particularly class solidarity between workers and soldiers of different countries. And if you read Benedict Anderson's great book, Imagined Communities, this makes a lot of sense. He obviously has a far more robust and scientific way of exploring it. But the development of the nation state since the late Renaissance has been based around this idea of kind of imagined notions of the collective. The reality is that, yes, German society was riven with class conflicts, with inequalities and differences, and even religious and ethnic difference. But when it comes down to it, and obviously development regional identity as well, when it comes down to it, that powerful sense of siege is what really brings about these dramatic changes in July 1914. Okay, I'm going to leave that there. If you found that useful, please go on to our iTunes page and give the Explaining History podcast a good review. We need your reviews. They all help. And I'll catch you hopefully later today with another Explaining History podcast. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.